Hank Neuer is a nationally recognized hazing expert and journalism professor at Indiana's Franklin College. He's published 4 books on the topic and even runs a website that tracks hazing events. I reached Mr. Neuer by phone to discuss the latest plea deals in the Florida A&M University hazing case, stemming from the death of drum major Robert Champion in November of 2011. You have 12 people who have been now charged with felony manslaughter, but we've seen already one of them has pled no contest and got a reduced sentence. One pled guilty, is probably going to get a reduced sentence, and one who was charged with misdemeanor hazing basically got community service. It seems like, you know, the charges are falling off as these people get closer and closer to trial. Is this unusual, and what's happening here?
It's not unusual. I mean, this month alone, we've saw arrests at Virginia State University after a hazing that resulted in drowning, and that's the second case at Virginia State University. Another one was in 1979, and after a great deal of hoopla, the charges get completely dropped. Now, each case is different. In Virginia State, it's a matter of the state feeling that it would be difficult to get a conviction when, in fact, the young men apparently went into the water out of their own volition. The same thing may be true in terms of Florida A&M, that Robert Champion, as Florida A&M argues, knew in advance what he was going to endure, that once he got in, he might be doing it to someone else as well, unless he turned out to be very unusual and would fight the practice. There were a lot of people on that bus. It's very difficult to pinpoint who struck the fatal blow, if there really was just one fatal blow. And it's very difficult as people close ranks to get a straight story. And there's a lot of confusion and bedlam there. Finally, the other part is it's not very politically popular for a prosecutor to charge these kind of cases. In the case of Ricky Wills, who pleaded no contest, he's there with his family. He's got an exemplary academic record. The courts are looking at someone like this, figuring that he has a shining life ahead of him and may be able to turn his life around. All those things factor into why I don't think we will be seeing very heavy charges in these hazing cases. It's more a matter of prevention, but it's sending a very clear message to students that that the punishments for hazing aren't going to be very stringent.
Let me ask you this question, right? Because when the state prosecutor's office first laid out the charges, they laid out felony hazing that results in a death. I think it carried like a maximum of 5 years.
And that plus was under manslaughter. Plus yeah. Manslaughter, right.
And then they bumped it up to manslaughter, which requires like a higher threshold. And I wonder if wouldn't the state have had better luck trying these under felony hazing that results in death when it was hazing and it resulted in a death?
It's very, very difficult to get these enforced. It's much, much easier with less of a preponderance of evidence to get a judgment in a civil suit by a family. And, you know, one thing I might add is that the parents of these victims, whether it's at Florida A&M or Virginia State, get very disappointed because it looks as if there's going to be some very tough justice, and in the end there is not. As I wrote for the Orlando Sentinel, after a death at Radford University of a fraternity member named Samuel Mason, the courts decided that there would be $1,000 fines for the perpetrators in that particular case. And so my comment was, what's a human life worth? $1,000 per man in a hazing death.
But I guess, you know, I guess maybe for me, what I something I didn't quite understand is, if you're going to charge these people, why ultimately settle for less? And I get what you're saying about, you know, it's hard for them to prosecute it, but it just seems to me like it would have been easier for the state to prosecute under their initial charge.
Hazing is something that when it goes to a jury and sometimes to a judge, and often with police themselves who are testifying, there's a different definition for hazing for each and every one of them. We saw a death just recently at the University of Idaho, a drowning death, where a pledge was asked by senior members to swim across a reservoir. A single detective investigated, decided that it was an accident, not hazing, closed case. Neither the university wants to open it wide up, nor the prosecutor. And actually, the national fraternity doesn't want to either. It just simply goes away unless a parent, like the champions, has some vociferous objections. And in spite of the fact that the champions are very, very articulate people, we're seeing in this particular case judgments that must be very, very disappointing to them.
You talked earlier about, you know, the lack of people wanting to speak. And I talked kind of just briefly on background with a spokeswoman for one of the attorneys of one of the people charged. And they said, you know, what they think may be happening is that they're these first, I guess, three or four people are getting reduced charges in the hopes that they'll flip and turn on the rest of the students. But I guess my question is, if you keep trying each one individually, how strong is that that kind of logic? I mean, will they flip? Will they turn? And would it even work?
I think here's the thing. Even though there's a lot of people there, there was complete chaos on there. And unless you were directly sitting next to somebody, it's going to be very, very difficult to recount in a court of law exactly what happened. There's going to be some changed stories. There's going to be some faulty memories. This is going to be a very difficult case. It isn't like somebody pulling out a gun and shooting someone. You're talking about a melee, basically, and you're talking about people in every seat striking out either with an object or fists. So you have pandemonium. And then the other part is, you know, the university itself making a very, very determined case that Robert Champion himself has to bear some responsibility. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm not saying that that isn't a terrible public relations decision, but certainly prosecutors are hearing those kinds of things.
How big of a deal is that in these? Because the university is dealing with its own lawsuit stemming from this. How big of a role does that go? You know, no one dragged Robert onto the bus. He willfully got on there. He pretty much knew what he was getting into. I mean, that has to be a prosecutor's nightmare.
Right. It shouldn't matter in Florida, where basically because of the Chad Meredith case, a young man who drowned in a hazing at Miami, the actions and complicity of the victim should not matter. But that's one thing to have it in a law, and it's another for when it comes to court. The other is we're dealing with these undergraduate students. Compare this to a death at Texas of a Republic crane operator who dangled somebody from a crane, had an accidental death, and then was sentenced to 18 years in prison while his buddy was given 5 years in prison. I don't see that ever happening in the United States with a collegiate case. Or look at the Philippines, where it's on the books that a hazing for a fraternity resulting from beatings could lead to a life sentence. That won't happen in the United States either.
Everybody made such a hubbub about Florida's hazing laws. Oh, they're the strictest in the nation. But, I mean, now you have a case, and it seems like, I mean, those laws, looking at what's happening, just kind of seem to be paper tigers.
They do seem to be paper tigers. It does seem that if hazing is going to be eradicated, it's going to have to come from the troop level with some voluntary actions on the part of fraternity members and athletes nationwide. It doesn't seem to be coming from any kind of punishment from the courts. Now, having said that, there is a key case involving members in Ohio from Youngstown State where sentencing is about to occur, and I'm watching that with interest to see if the sentencing is any tougher than the Florida A&M sentencing.
Right after this, we kind of even saw some action in Congress, right? We had Congresswoman Frederica Wilson file a bill in Congress. Any traction on the national level?
That bill wasn't written quite as well as it might have been. It really does seem apparently that we're not going to put any faith into a federal bill. It's going to have to be tough laws state by state. On the other hand, it must be discouraging to hazing activists or to parents to have what looked like an airtight Florida law and then to get people plead no contest and serve no jail time. One other one, there was a death at Ferris State where the young man actually served some time and got a felony, and about 5 years, maybe 7 years afterwards, a judge took away the felony, which I know in speaking to the mother kind of broke the heart of the mother whose son was killed in that particular incident. So the courts have been very, very light on hazing in the United States. We have had about 173 hazing deaths. The combined total of all those deaths has been just a couple of years, really, in jail. There's one in Chico State where a young man in a water torture case served 1 year. We've had the case that you mentioned in Florida where there were 2 year sentences, but that's about the extent of it. Otherwise, it's just a few days, maybe a month in jail, fines, or probation.
And 173 cases, in what frame of time?
That goes back to 1873, which was the first death in a fraternity at Cornell. There was one earlier at a seminary in Kentucky, but the first one, but records were burned in that particular school. And the biggest one would be 1873, the death of Mortimer Leggett at Cornell University, who fell to his death on a kind of march, and there was a blindfold nearby him, and he died in that particular incident.
Well, Dr. Neuer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye. We just heard from hazing expert Hank Neuer, who tracks hazing incidents around the world. Now we turn to Chuck Hobbs, a Tallahassee attorney. Hobbs currently represents one of the defendants in the FAMU hazing case, Caleb Jackson, who pleaded guilty to felony charges in exchange for his testimony. In 2007, Hobbs represented two members of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity at FAMU, charged with felony hazing and the beating of a pledge. So what is happening here? Because it seems like we have, 12 people who have had their charges bumped up to manslaughter, but yet as we're starting to see these cases kind of come to the stage where they're getting ready to go to trial, they're either being settled for reduced charges, or students are taking plea deals. And it seems that, with something as serious as manslaughter, they're being settled for a lot less than that. And I'm curious to know, A, how frequent this kind of thing occurs in hazing cases, or, is it just kind of too early to tell on this level? What's going on?
What I can say from what I know so far, without getting too deep into some of the sensitive conversations I've had representing Caleb, I can tell you that what I do know is that while you have a number of individuals who are charged, each individual had a different level of responsibility. Let's just put it that way, with respect to what ultimately went down. So, and again, that's not atypical. When you have cases involving multiple defendants, oftentimes everybody is charged with the same offense, but as you wade through the facts and you start dealing with folks individually instead of collectively, sometimes defendant A might get a better deal than defendant J would be, so to speak. And so let me throw a hypothetical out, and it relates to the Champion case, but I'm just going to throw a hypothetical out. So if let's say there were a number of defendants that are charged with the hazing of said individual, and let's say one person may have just been standing there shouting encouragement, like, hey, yeah, take your licks, whereas they may have evidence that another person actually had the paddle or the belt or whatever that was used to do the hazing, but the person that was administering the licks. There are times, I'm not saying every case, but there are times that certain prosecutors might offer the person who was there just shouting encouragement a different deal than they might offer the person was actually administering the beating.
So, are we going to see these kind of things continue, or is there going to come to a point where, the more people who are charged, the higher and more severe the sentences will be?
Let me tell you what I honestly think. I think that once Caleb pled and agreed to cooperate, I would not be shocked if a good number, if not all, of these defendants don't eventually enter some type of plea to resolve the case. I think that once they enhance the charges to manslaughter, the potential penalties are so high, even the fact that you're exposed to that type of time. If I had a son or a daughter that was charged like that, and you were able to potentially work out a deal where they're not a convicted felon and they're just on probation, I would definitely strongly encourage that child of mine to take that, because the flip side is, if you roll the dice and go to trial, and if you lose, that you could be sentenced to prison. And that's too big of a risk for some of these students to take. So my gut is that I think the majority, if not all, of these students will eventually enter pleas in the case.
You know, it makes me wonder, too, about, like, the flip side of this, right? Because you have, you know, and this is kind of with any case when something like this occurs, and you get a charge of manslaughter and someone pleads just for probation from a person who may have been the victim, I would feel kind of let down. You know, you got my expectations all up, and then all they get is, you know, probation.
Right. And you know, that's one of the interesting things, Lynn. And again, when I say I don't have a crystal ball, but I do have the sense, again, that most of these cases will resolve, but I don't think all of them will resolve for probation. Because, again, what I already know from the information I've received so far in working on this case is that different people have different levels of culpability. Now, again, when I did the Capahazen case 7 years ago, one of my clients and another young man who was represented by Attorney Richard Allen out of West Palm Beach, they were convicted. Two of the five defendants were convicted and got sentenced to 2 years prison. So I still don't think it's far-fetched that some of the people that the prosecutors in Orlando think are the more culpable with respect to actually administering the beatings may not serve some prison time. It's still very possible that that might be what happens. And if that's the case, Lynn, what you will wind up happening is this. Throw out what just happened with Rokai Wills. Like, let's say if Defendant X is a person that the prosecutor's office has denoted as being a person they believe was an active hitter or striker of Robert Champion. And again, no one has said this to me. This is just me just having been a defense attorney and having been a prosecutor before. It's a good chance that that person may not get an offer for probation. That person's offer may be only to prison. And if that's the case, then that defendant would only have two choices. One would be potentially to plead straight up to the judge and ask the judge for mercy, or two, to go to trial. And so you could see that too. I neglected to say that earlier when I was going on about how I think all the cases were resolved. But I do know that they have identified certain people as being people that they believe may have had more culpability than others. And I think that's why Rokai Wills was able to get the deal that he got, because I don't think he was one of those individuals that they believe to be one of the main hazers, so to speak.
What are the difficulties, I guess, on the prosecutorial side of trying to try one of these?
Manslaughter. It's a high offense. It's a very difficult offense to prove, particularly in this situation. Now, when you're dealing with manslaughter, you're dealing with something that we call culpable negligence, where you're not necessarily trying to prove that somebody intended for Robert Champion to die. I don't think that anybody believes that the students that were there that night hoped for Robert Champion to die. But at the same time, he did die. So when you're charging manslaughter, you're saying that someone was negligent, but you do have to prove that the person was negligent. And I'm going to tell you that, to me, was always going to be difficult for the prosecutors to prove. And if it does go to trial, I still think it would be difficult for them to prove, because it was absolute chaos from what I know so far on that bus that night. It was extremely dark. If you've ever been on a bus at night, you know it's already dark even when the bus is on with the little dim lights, but they didn't even have the lights on in there. It was dark. You could hear voices, but it was very difficult to be able to tell who was doing what. And so in this situation, prosecutor is going to have a difficult time being able to prove. When you say the death blow, the legal phrase for that is called the proximate cause. Like, what was the proximate cause of Robert Champion's death? And pretty simply, the question we ask is, but for X happening, would Robert Champion have died? And that's going to be hard for them. Whereas with hazing, it's much easier. All you have to prove is that the person was in the organization. You have to prove that the person was there, and that the person either encouraged, assisted, or abetted, so to speak, the person taking licks or whatever, or the person was actually giving out the licks. So I always knew that the felony hazing charge was a smart charge, because that's pretty easy. If you can prove that defendant A through J was on the bus, you're halfway there in a hazing charge. But the other complication that prosecutors have in this situation which makes it for, it's going to be difficult not only for the criminal cases, but for the civil case that the Champion family has filed, is that Robert Champion actually signed an agreement to not submit to hazing. And the reason that's important is, I know some people will say, well, so what? It still shouldn't have happened. And I agree with that. It shouldn't have happened. He shouldn't have been beaten, and he definitely should still be alive. But from a legal standpoint, there could be jurors who sit there in that jury box, and they, when they take a look at that form, and they see that he was 26 years old, that he read through the form, that he signed the form without anybody placing him under duress, a jury could conclude, you know what, it's very unfortunate that this young man died, but he assumed the risk, so to speak, of placing himself in that position in the first place. So, again, these are no slam dunk cases for the prosecution at all. Very, very difficult cases. Again, three of the defendants in the Kappa Hazen case, they had hung juries twice, you know, and then eventually, instead of going to a third trial, the three that were not convicted after the second trial, they entered pleas to the misdemeanors, even though they had been originally charged with felony hazing. They pled to misdemeanor hazing and just got community service time. So, you know, that's very important to show that jurors sometimes have a difficult time being able to come back with a finding of guilt in these situations, because they're thinking, okay, these are adults, these aren't children and what have you, who are being taken advantage of by adults. On the flip side, Robert Champion was a full-grown 26-year-old man, and that definitely would be the centerpiece of any defense. So it's going to be tough for prosecutors. There's no doubt about it.
So why in the world, right, if it was easier to get these kids on felony hazing that results in death, why just not get them on felony hazing that results in death, right? It's like a guaranteed 5 years versus taking the risk of, you know, having a manslaughter charge thrown out and nothing happens.
Absolutely. I think the thing is, I think that's the end result. I think that's what the prosecutor's office would like to have happen. And I think that by adding the manslaughter charge, you're hoping to throw in that fear element whereby a 20, 22, 25-year-old kid who's got his life ahead of him or her looks at it and says, you know what, I better go ahead and enter a plea and try to get the best thing I can get, as opposed to potentially having a manslaughter charge stick to me.
How does this bode, especially some of the early outcomes that we're seeing, I guess, does it damage or lessen the perception of hazing, considering how in so many of these cases, it kind of seems like people just got slaps on the wrist and it goes away?
That's another good question. I'm a member of a Greek organization. I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi myself, and I participate on some of our message boards that we have, you know, and a lot of prominent men are on those message boards, men who are lawyers, judges, and every doggone thing else, every other walk of life. And one of the things that I see that's a pervasive theme among the older or the elder Kappas is that we believe that even with the cases that you're seeing prosecuted across the country as felonies, that you're right. Other than the two young men who spent the 2 years in prison in the Kappa Hazen case, I have yet to see any other case result in sentences even close to that harshness. And because of that, a lot of older brothers believe that until prosecutor offices start putting people in prison 5, 10 years or longer on some of these charges, that it's not going to resonate the same way. Because at the end of the day, a lot of these students are simply hard-headed, and they don't believe that anything is going to happen to them beyond, worst-case scenario, a slap on the wrist. And so I definitely share your concern about that. But again, the legislatures and the individual states are charged with being able to set policy with respect to how long they want a sentence to be. And again, I know they could have made that here in Florida a second-degree felony punishable by up to 15 years, but for whatever reason, they chose to fix a third-degree felony status to hazing. But you could see that readdressed at some point in time in Florida or other states where prosecutors and judges have higher level of penalties that they can assess in order to get some people's attention, because it really, it's a problem that does not seem to be going away. You would think that with all of the bad publicity that Florida A&M got back in 2011 and 12 after Robert Champion died, you would think that across the country, no other students would want to involve themselves in such activities, but it does not stop. It simply does not. It seems to keep going on, and it's because of what you say. Most people don't believe that they're going to do a day of time if they're actually charged with these offenses.
We didn't even see any bills this year, so
but
I was kind of surprised
about that. Lynn, is that deep down inside, what you find is that there are a lot of men and women, black, white, and Latino, who went through Greek systems or different hazings themselves in high school or college to join organizations. And I think that to a great extent what you have is that there just aren't enough men and women who think that it is that big enough of a deal at the end of the day. They think that the deaths, obviously, are a big deal when it gets to that point. But the problem is that most of these instances don't lead to death. And so until folks start to take it seriously like we do sexual battery or any of a number of other offenses, again, you're not going to see the type of deterrent factor that I think that many citizens across the country are looking for.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hobbs. Appreciate it.
And I appreciate you, too.
Thanks to our guests, Hank Neuer and Chuck Hobbs. Attorneys for the state and family of Robert Champion did not return requests for comment. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provided technical assistance. Please join us again next week for more discussion on the issues impacting our state.